coronavirus continues its march across the globe. It's in Iran's prison system.
There's no bleach, no disinfectants, there was no sanitizer, hand gel, and the only medicines they'd got were aspirin.
And the third time is not the charm. Israeli voters head to the polls for the third time in less than a year. For some voters, a choice is just as tough as it was in round one.
It's not a matter who am I voting for, it's more who am I voting against.
And in London, security cameras everywhere. When does surveillance go too far?
Members of the public in our everyday lives are effectively being subjected to a police lineup, a constant police lineup.
And saying goodbye to this. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us this Monday. Just how widespread is the coronavirus? That is a question everybody wants answered. Scientists are racing to figure it out. We do know it's spreading quickly and appears to be more fatal than the seasonal flu. New cases continue to emerge in Italy, Iran, and South Korea, and here in the United States. Today, the worldwide death toll passed 3,000. Fighting this thing together and quickly, says the head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, is the only way to succeed.
With early aggressive measures, countries can stop transmission and save lives.
There are some slivers of good news. The number of reported cases in China is slowing down, although in the city of Wuhan, where the coronavirus outbreak began 5 weeks ago, the lockdown is still in place. Public transportation, schools, and businesses all still shut down. Many people unable to leave their homes. And now a grassroots network of volunteers is taking matters into its own hands. Rebecca Canther has her story from Shanghai.
Evan Zhou owns his own wine and spirits import business in Wuhan, China. But now, instead of delivering to bars and restaurants, he and his friends drive medical supplies to overwhelmed hospitals. When doctors began pleading for help on social media, Evan and his friends sprang into action, sourcing masks, gloves, and protective suits from factories and getting them delivered to Wuhan. Most of them are like him, young, single, living on their own and with their own cars.
We can speak English and we know a lot of people outside, so we raise money and buy stuff.
Evan and many of his friends learned English and went to college abroad, where they made new friends outside of China. They've used that network to raise money and find supplies. Stuck at home, they're using social media like WeChat to communicate.
The first couple of days, I just sitting there typing WeChat all the time, maybe 10-hour days.
His phone was lighting up at all hours of the day as he coordinated supplies and drivers. Like Evan, many people in Wuhan have found ways to fill gaps left by the government. A woman passed out surgical masks to street cleaners who had no protection. Social workers offer online support to people with special needs, including those who are deaf and blind. Donors send supplies of menstrual products and adult diapers to overworked doctors and nurses. And volunteers drive medical workers to and from work.
Things still bad. We know a lot of hospital staff. Still, they don't have enough.
While the government has been bringing in relief workers and supplies to the biggest hospitals, Evan says the smaller ones are struggling. One thing has become clear during this outbreak. People don't trust the big charities here. Jane Chun in Shanghai organized several fundraising drives through her friend networks on WeChat.
Before, it was always just donating to the big organization, and we don't know where the money flows. Personally, I don't really trust, you know, big organization like Red Cross, especially in China. So much scandal has been discovered, so I don't trust them.
One of those scandals was the discovery in early February that donations to the Hubei Red Cross weren't making it to the hospitals on the front line. This video was recently posted online. The voices are distorted, but what it shows is a local Red Cross official putting a box of masks in his own car, confirming yet again the corruption people suspected. One thing you should know, China's Red Cross is separate from the International Red Cross. Like many large charities in the country, it's basically controlled by the government. There are private foundations as well, but strict laws make it difficult for them to raise funds. So Jane, like many others, utilizes her friend circle to raise money for supplies, even though she could get in trouble with the law.
There are a few very resourceful friends who also organize those donations with me, so I just trust them.
Volunteers like Jane and Evan and so many others in China feel called to take action.
It might sound a bit cliche, but I just love my country. I want to help whenever it needs us.
But volunteers are finding the government doesn't always support their efforts. This week, Evan is stuck at home, unable to go out at all. The government in Wuhan has put new restrictions in place, and he can't figure out how to get the new permit he needs to be able to drive his car on the streets. But once he gets his hands on one, he says he'll be back at work, delivering supplies to those who need them. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
After China comes Iran in terms of fatalities from COVID-19. More than 50 people in Iran have reportedly died from the disease caused by the coronavirus. Several senior Iranian officials there have contracted the virus. The disease is also reported to have infected the three main prisons in the capital, Tehran. The family of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, a British-Iranian woman, believes she may have it. She's serving a 5-year sentence for espionage, a charge Zaghari Ratcliffe has consistently denied. I spoke earlier with her husband, Richard Ratcliffe, who's in London.
She's demonstrating all of the symptoms of coronavirus. So she had shortness of breath, she's had a temperature, she's had body pain all over, difficulty breathing at points. And what started when we thought it sounded like a cold, but it's just lingered and lingered and lingered. From the middle of last week, we were seeing reports of prisoners being taken ill, people being taken to hospital, and the government being very odd in insisting that there were no confirmed cases inside the prison. And that was partly because it wasn't actually testing anyone. And Nazanin's been trying to get tested since Friday of last week. And there's been no ability to get herself tested at all. We have had a ban on any new prisoners coming into the prison. And also there's been a furlough, which is where they start releasing people temporarily. So there's been a lot of strange things that have happened. And the fact that the authorities are refusing to test her, it made me get very suspicious. What I got to be most alarmed by last week was that the prison had run out of all cleaning materials. So there was no bleach, there was no disinfectants, there was no sanitizing hand gel. And the only medicines they'd got were aspirin. That felt very ominous. So I can't hand on heart say she's definitely got it because it's not been confirmed, but she definitely needs to be tested.
And how have you been getting information specifically about your wife, Nazanin?
So we get phone calls. I spoke to Nazanin most recently directly on Saturday, and then she spoke to her family yesterday. And then obviously I'm in touch with a number of families. So that's families of Americans who are held, families of other Europeans who are held. And we're comparing notes all the time about the conditions in different parts of the prison.
Do you know how inmates are generally treated in Iran when they're ill?
So the prison system, from our experience, is a very reluctant to providing medical care. They will react in life and death situations. This is probably a bit overwhelming for the country as a whole, but certainly it's always a struggle to get any outside healthcare. And the doctors in the prison will, you know, if you're having a heart attack, you might get moved out, but short of that, you'll be given an aspirin and told to go back and rest. Certainly what we've seen from all the prisoners taking complaints this past week to the prison clinic is that they've been told to go back and rest and been told they're fine and they've just got a cold. And that's what's been told again and again. And as I say, the clinic had run out of anything apart from aspirin. So it's got no ability to really treat anything.
What is your most optimistic hope of how Iran should respond to what apparently is your wife's illness?
Well, so my most optimistic hope for Nazanin is, I mean, I'm pretty sure she's got it, but that she will recover. And certainly talking through with a number of doctors here, if you are young and if you've got a pretty good immune system and you've never had respiratory problems before, chances are you'll survive. It feels to me that this is a horrible experience for her and she's struggling day by day, but it's not getting worse and worse day by day. So hopefully she'll pull through it. I really think they should. You know, the UK should be pressuring them to make sure she's tested, to make sure all the British citizens there are tested. That the US government should be doing the same for its citizens. And generally, you know, there needs to be a push on the Iranian regime that it's not okay to just leave prisoners to their fate.
Richard, your daughter came to live with you last year from Iran. How is she doing in the UK? And have you shared with her any of this latest news?
Yeah, so she knows mummy's ill, and she's 5 and a half, so she's not particularly old, and that means that she understands but doesn't worry about things in quite the same way. Mm. Obviously, she knew I was busy doing lots of interviews the past couple of days and was a bit resentful that I wasn't around to play with her. But yes, you're right, she's come back to the UK from Iran about 4 or 5 months ago now. Her English is much better, she's settled into school, and probably really beginning to relax into being here. Been good for me as well. I spent, you know, now it was, 4 years I was essentially being a campaigning father and a campaigning husband. Now having to learn again to be a real one.
Richard Ratcliffe speaking with us from London. He's the husband of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who is detained in Iran and suspected to have COVID-19. Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Remain in Mexico or wait in detention in the U.S. For many migrants, that is a surprisingly easy choice. The Remain in Mexico program was devised by the Trump administration. It lets U.S. immigration officials return certain asylum seekers to wait in Mexico for court hearings to be scheduled here in the U.S. Nearly 60,000 migrants, including families with children, have been sent back to Mexico through the program. Last week, a federal court called the program illegal and suspended it. Here's immigration attorney Lisa Knox.
I'm actually very shocked. I mean, I'm still digesting the decision, but I thought it was such a good decision. I was not clear from the oral argument that they were going to go the way they did.
But then a few hours later, after the initial excitement, the same court hit pause on its ruling, and the Remain in Mexico program became active again. The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, has been following the back and forth and has been speaking with impacted migrants.
Everyone's situation is different, but nobody's situation is easy. They are working often under the table. They're living in very rough areas of town. It's a very day-to-day or week-to-week situation while they wait for their court proceedings. One man I talked to over the weekend, his name is Estuardo Cifuentes. He's in a slightly different situation. He's 31 years old. He left Guatemala because he said he's gay and was assaulted and threatened very violently by the police in Guatemala. He's in Matamoros, Mexico, just across the Texas border from Brownsville. He ran a publicity advertising agency in Guatemala, so he has a little bit of money. And he's renting a room in a pretty dodgy neighborhood of Matamoros, but it's still a very, very scary situation. And he told me what happens on Friday nights.
Ellos vienen por lo regular los viernes por la noche a mi casa con armas. Pago aproximadamente $75 a la semana.
Monica, what's he telling you there?
Every Friday night, he has to be home after 6 o'clock because a group of armed men come to his house and demand that he hands them $75. And he believes these men are with the Gulf Cartel, which is heavily present in this part of Mexico.
He visto ellos traen la lista y van anotando ahí el dinero que recaudan y ya y la hora a la que pasan.
He's saying they have a list and they note how much he's paid. They cross his name off the list and then they move on.
So, Estuardo, as he's sitting there waiting with this Remain in Mexico program, I mean, what's he thinking? What's he feeling about all this?
I asked him that very question, and what he told me is not what you would necessarily expect.
Prefería estar durante todo el proceso detenido que estar en México, porque es muy inseguro estar acá.
He said he would rather be detained in a cell in a detention center in the United States than waiting here in Mexico because it's so dangerous there.
So that's one case of a migrant who's waiting in Mexico. How typical is Estuardo's story?
The ability he has to rent a room is actually pretty rare from what I've seen. A lot of people are staying in crowded shelters or they're sharing one single room with four or five other people. I've seen that definitely along the border. And then we've also, of course, have these encampments on the Mexico side where, you know, you lack basic services. Hygiene is a major concern. Whole families living in tents. That is definitely a circumstance that's affecting hundreds and hundreds of people.
And why does the Trump administration want to keep this program in place? Why is it important to them?
Well, it's trying to make asylum seeking much harder. They say that it's not right that people seeking asylum stay in the United States, live here. The administration feels that a lot of these people have dubious asylum claims, and then they end up just staying in the United States.
So federal court blocks Remain in Mexico. Now it's back. What are you going to be looking out for next, Monica?
We'll see whether the program remains on or is suspended. The migrants themselves are also watching this very closely. They are holding out hope in this program. Estuardo, who I talked to, he's got a court hearing later in March, and he's going to go, he says, because he's holding out that he may get asylum, even though fewer than 2% of the people in this Remain in Mexico program get asylum.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, speaking with us about the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico program. Thank you very much, Monica.
You're welcome.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. It's not Groundhog Day, but it might feel like it for Israelis. They voted again today, the third time in 12 months. Exit polls show Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's party with a clear lead, but there is an enduring deadlock in Israeli politics. A big part of it has to do with ultra-Orthodox Jews serving in the Israeli army. Military service is compulsory for Jewish 18-year-olds, but only a small percentage of the ultra-Orthodox actually serve. For many Israelis who voted today, the religious character of the country is top of mind. The world's Ariel Osaron has a story.
Hundreds of young men, and it's only men, in matching black hats and coats, are crammed into a giant study hall in Beit Shemesh. The town is about half an hour drive outside of Jerusalem. It's a political rally for members of one branch of ultra-Orthodox Judaism. They're here to listen to their rabbis talk about the election. One by one, the rabbis urge the crowd in Yiddish, get out and vote.
We come out here to support the religious parties and to support the Torah and the religious people.
31-year-old Yehuda Braun tells me he'll be voting for United Torah Judaism, one of the big ultra-Orthodox political parties. Braun says the non-religious parties want to exclude the ultra-Orthodox population from Israeli politics and change their way of life.
We just want to learn the Torah and we want to let us live our life. That's it.
Tzuchi Reich was born in Brooklyn and moved here as a teenager. He's only 33, but he's got five kids already. I ask him what's at stake in the election, and Reich says the ultra-Orthodox like him should not have to serve in the Israeli army.
We can't serve because if we will, we'll have to change our way of life, and it's more important our way of life than even than the country.
Reich says it's not just the political left that's against the religious population, but the right-wing Israel Beitenu party as well. It's led by Avigdor Lieberman. He's a veteran politician and a former ally of Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, Lieberman and Netanyahu are bitter rivals. In fact, their political falling out was a big reason why Israel is now holding its third election in a year. The religious parties are Netanyahu's most important partners, but Lieberman is now seen as a threat to ultra-Orthodox leaders like Health Minister Yaakov Litzman.
But you sat with Lieberman in many governments until now.
The guy is a big gangster.
That political split on the Israeli right between the ultra-Orthodox and Lieberman was a game-changer, says Yochanan Plessner. He's the head of the Israel Democracy Institute.
The choice of Lieberman to extract himself from the right-wing plus ultra-Orthodox coalition, it represents the growing concern of his constituency about those matters of religion and state.
Plessner says Lieberman supporters tend to be secular. They want everybody to serve in the army. And they're worried that the religious parties have too much influence in government. These are big concerns for Lena Kagan. She works for a pharmaceutical company and has three kids. They live in a town called Rehovot, outside of Tel Aviv. The oldest of her three children is 18 and will soon be in uniform. Kagan says she's voting against the religious parties.
It's strange that there is a group of people who are privileged not to contribute to the society or to the country the same way as other group of people have to.
Kagan says it doesn't make sense for the government to subsidize the ultra-Orthodox community just so its young people, most of whom don't even serve in the military, can keep studying Torah full time.
My kids have to go to the army and their kids can just sit and learn. So this is such a basic lack of equal rights that is unbelievable.
The scene on the beach here in Tel Aviv could not be more different than the political rally in Beit Shemesh. Men and women sit together, sipping drinks and playing paddleball. It's easy to find people on the secular side of the political spectrum. A 29-year-old software engineer, who doesn't want me to use his name, says he will not be voting for Netanyahu because, he says, the prime minister has become too reliant on the ultra-Orthodox.
They are not contributing to the economy. They are also not contributing to the army. So it's a whole part of the population that is not really contributing to what makes Israel great today.
But he goes on to say he's got nothing personal against the religious community. Some of his family members are ultra-Orthodox.
I think there can be a balance between Jewish values and values of the country. And I think they are not integrated in the country, and I think it has to change.
The divide between religious and secular in Israel is deep, and it's not going away anytime soon. Recent polling shows that a majority of Israeli voters want more space for secular life. They're in favor, for example, of allowing public transportation on the Sabbath, and they want rabbis to have less control over institutions like marriage. But here's the irony. A lot of those same Israelis still vote for Netanyahu and his religious partners. For The World, Ariel Osaran, Tel Aviv.
I've never liked waiting for buses, trains, or planes. Who does? But at least with that big departures board, you can enjoy the spinning numbers and the clicking letters while you wait. For you young travelers, I might be describing something that sounds like it came from years ago, and you'd be right. Here's The World's Amanda McGowan.
For decades, travelers at Changi Airport in Singapore were well acquainted with this. That's a Solari board. The clacking you're hearing is thousands of cards with letters and numbers on them, flipping manually to display the names of flight numbers, cities, and arrival and departure times. These boards used to be everywhere, in train stations and airports. But for years, they've been slowly disappearing and being replaced with digital technology. Singapore's airport board is the latest casualty. It was taken offline last week. But that doesn't mean that this technology is dead, or at least not entirely.
The Solari signs have popped up in all kinds of ways, where people have salvaged the technology and then used it in imaginative new ways.
That's Matt Sore. He's a professor at Concordia University in Montreal. He collects old signs around Montreal, including old Solari airport signs. He says one way these signs are being repurposed is through art. Here's an example. In the late 2000s, artist George Sanchez Calderon was looking to create a piece about the rise of globalism. He stumbled on the old Solari board from Boston's South Station, which was for sale. And it was a match made in heaven.
I thought it was the perfect object that existed, that personified like the height of the analog age and transition to digital.
Sanchez Calderon built a somewhat dizzying display with the Solari board rapidly changing over. And in the process, he fell in love with these intricate machines.
It has 394 individual motors and machines inside of it. It's a serious piece of mechanical engineering.
There's also the potential for what Sore calls a boutique revival. You know how you can buy vinyl record players or instant Polaroid-style cameras? There might be a second life for Solaris too, in a limited way.
To me, the technology that was brand new and shiny and wonderful when it first emerged in the 50s, but a little bit like neon, it's sort of experiencing a little bit of a renaissance.
Sore says you might see these boards soon in a hipster bar near you, displaying the latest microbrews. Singapore's Solari board will also have a second life. All of its thousands of pieces are being dismantled and cleaned. This process will take an estimated 6 months. Then the board will be shipped to Singapore's National Collection. Final destination? History. For The World, I'm Amanda McGowan.
And according to the big board, you're listening to The World. The U.S. and the Taliban have struck a deal that's got this Afghan woman worried.
What is it going to happen? They're going to put us all behind the walls again? What is it going to be?
And Berlin musicians look for inspiration at a fish and chips shop.
Which was interesting because it always smelled like pancakes. I don't know if that influenced the music, but it was kind of nice.
Coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. One of the most heavily watched cities on Earth is London. The British capital has something like 420,000 CCTV cameras in place. Compare that to Washington, D.C., with a comparatively modest 30,000 cameras. And now the Metropolitan Police Force is going a step further, using live facial recognition cameras. In recent weeks, that technology has come to some parts of London. As The World's Orla Barry in London discovered, there's plenty of opposition.
It's a wet weekday evening in East London, and I'm with a group of people making its way through the neighbourhood's busy streets. Nobody speaks, but lots of people stare. All of our faces are painted in what's called CV Dazzle. It's a type of camouflage makeup. Basically, I look like a superfan on my way to a big soccer match. But the idea is this. If the makeup is applied correctly, live facial recognition cameras can't detect you.
It's kind of just quite daunting knowing that there's
maybe not somebody watching, but there's something watching you most of the time.
Artist Evie Price is leading tonight's walk with the Dazzle Club. Every month the group invites people to walk in silence, in makeup, through different areas in London. She tells me she worries about what happens with all the digital information that police cameras are collecting.
What are they doing with that technology? What are they doing with the data that they're collecting? They say it's for safety purposes and preventative policing, but we have no evidence that what they're actually using it for is working or it's being effective.
Price and the Dazzle Club aren't the only ones with concerns. When the London Police announced they were planning to roll out facial recognition technology last month, civil liberty organisations pounced. Silky Carlo is with an organisation called Big Brother Watch.
I think the deeper challenge that facial recognition poses is that it actually starts to reverse the presumption of innocence. Because it's a mass surveillance technology that not only watches but checks identities, it means that members of the public in our everyday lives are effectively being subjected to a police lineup, a constant police lineup, and constantly having our identities checked to make sure that we're not criminals.
Police cameras in London are active for hours at a time, but not 24/7. They work by scanning people's faces and then comparing those images to a watch list of suspects. Assistant Police Commissioner Nick Efgrave says the system does not store images of random people's faces.
Every image that is looked at by the technology, if there is no match, it's instantaneously deleted. The only images that are retained are those where there's been an alert, and they are retained for a maximum of 31 days.
Police say the cameras are mostly accurate, that they can identify 70% of suspects walking past, but an independent review of the technology came up with very different results. That study was carried out by Pete Fussey. He's a professor at Essex University and an expert in surveillance technology.
On the six trials that I observed, there were 42 times in which the facial recognition system alerted operators that someone had passed the cameras, which was matched the database. And in only 8 of those cases was it verifiably correct that that person was verifiably, without any doubt, the person that had been matched.
That's an accuracy rate of just 19%. But facial recognition cameras are becoming more common. In addition to the Metropolitan Police, shop owners around Britain are also using them. FaceWatch is a for-profit company that provides the technology. It says retailers want facial recognition cameras because the police don't have the time or the resources to deal with low-level crimes like shoplifting. Nick Fisher is the CEO of FaceWatch.
And it's proving to be really effective. And everywhere we've deployed FaceWatch today, within 90 days of deployment, all our businesses have reported a greater than 25% reduction in store theft. And without question, the employees in the store, they're reporting that they feel a lot safer.
But Silky Carlo from the group Big Brother Watch says there's a real downside here.
This is a real worry because then we have basically privatised policing. I'm sure everyone knows what it feels like to walk out of a shop and feel the eyes of a security guard on your back. And, you know, maybe they think that they saw something they didn't see. Or now what they have the ability to do is put your face on a watch list. And every time you go into that shop, create an alert. And in fact, they're sharing that with other retailers in the area as well.
Facial recognition technology is so new that the legal system has yet to catch up. The European Commission, for example, is considering a ban on the technology in public places for 3 to 5 years, while regulations are put in place. And there's a legal challenge making its way through the UK's court system. But London police seem determined to press on. The police commissioner recently dismissed complaints by saying that concerns about privacy feel much, much smaller than worrying about a knife through the chest. Back in East London, Anna Hart with the Dazzle Club says she's not buying it.
A 15-year-old was stabbed in my street opposite my house 2 days ago. This stuff didn't keep him safe.
We finished the walk at a local pub and I asked Claudia and James, who joined the group, what they learned from the experience of trying to fool the cameras.
I found it quite enlightening, actually. I don't often walk through London in silence, let alone with my face painted. I thought I was going to get stared at and heckled at, and actually, weirdly, people ignored us on the whole.
Facial recognition is a huge thing already, especially if you look at what's happened in China. It just seemed a really nice way of pushing back against that.
The Dazzle Club is planning its next protest walk later this month. but the police appear to have the government on their side. The majority Conservatives are promising to empower the police with new technologies. It might take more than camouflage makeup to prevent live facial recognition cameras from becoming part of the new normal. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
It didn't last long. The partial truce between the US and the Taliban seems to have fallen apart less than 48 hours after it began. Afghanistan's government rejected the timeline for a proposed prisoner swap, so Taliban officials say they're resuming military operations. It's important to note that Afghanistan's government was not included in the talks that led up to the deal. We wanted to know how the shaky beginning to the peace process is seen by Afghanistan's women. So we reached out to Mahbuba Siraj.
I don't think they're doing it the right way.
Siraj is a women's rights advocate in Kabul. She told me she thought the peace process was flawed from the get-go.
This is a country with a government. This is a democracy. We have institutions. Of course, they're not working perfectly, but then nobody's as really. We cannot let 5,000, 6,000 Taliban be on the streets of this country without any due process.
So what do you think is the right way to forge a path to peace?
At least the first step that we are taking, it has to be the right first step. First of all, the inclusion of representatives of people of Afghanistan, the women, the people that have lost their legs and their limbs, you know, during this war, the young generation. We are not saying that we have to be 500 of us, but whoever we are, you know, one or two representatives from all of the different sectors in this country have to be there, and especially women have to be there because we are 50% of this country.
Were women represented in these first steps of this peace agreement? And are you hopeful women will be players in going forward?
This agreement was really signed between, you know, United States and the Taliban. So there was nobody there. We were not there. The Afghan government was not there. No one was there. So it was them. But going forward, I really hope that the Afghan women are going to be there. That is good for the Taliban, is good for us, is good for the future of Afghanistan. It's a must, and we have to be there.
I hear your concerns. I think a lot of people share those concerns about the way forward. But we should also point out that Afghanistan today is very different from the country the Taliban ruled in the 1990s. There are dozens of women who hold seats in parliament today.
Absolutely.
They serve in the cabinet, the security forces, they're judges, they're prosecutors. They make up about 20% of university graduates. I'm wondering if you really believe the Taliban can threaten all of that progress.
It is very different, the Afghanistan of today, from the Afghanistan of 19 years ago. Very different. We are not even the same people. How do they even think that they can do that? We are teachers. We are professors. We are doctors. We are engineers. We are building this country. We really want to do that. We are all of that. We are everywhere. So what is it going to happen? They're going to kill us all, put us all in behind the walls again? Dear God, this is not possible. You know, all of these things are happening because somebody somewhere has an entirely different agenda. And the agenda has nothing to do with peace coming here. No, it's because somebody wants to become the president of the United States and wants to say that, you know, I did the work and I did the job and now I'm here. We are in need of the world's help for, you know that. I know that. We all know that. The United States know that. If they don't pay our soldiers right now, they're going to die of hunger.
It sounds like you've got concerns that this Taliban-U.S. agreement is being driven by the White House's political concerns.
Of course. It's not a rocket science, for God's sakes. I mean, these are forces in the world that drives different things, and politics is number one. So, yeah, definitely, you know, that has a lot to do with it.
The U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad, and his team, have they listened to the women of Afghanistan? Have they included your concerns and those of other women on their agenda?
Yeah, well, we kept on asking him, please involve, you know, more women. So when you come, talk to a bigger group of us. Don't choose, you know, just, you know, two or three women that you feel comfortable with and can talk to. Listen to some challenging and difficult questions. I believe in my mind that's the nature of this whole thing. So it did not happen the way we were hoping it would. So, yeah, so, you know, so here we are.
So what role are you hoping the U.S. government plays as these efforts for peace continue, specifically the kind of tone you want to hear regarding the future of women in Afghanistan?
this population of this country are made of men and women, young and old and children. And all of these people, especially the women, because they are 50% of the population, do need to be there at the table and do need to raise their voice. We were hoping that they would make a point, you know, to the Taliban that when you sit down with the intra-Afghan, make sure that you do have women, you know, at these talks, you know, sitting there. The women of this country are the grassroots. They're the ones living the life every single day. It's not that we all have to be, you know, these monsters and keep on, you know, just killing each other all the time. It's the human face of the whole situation.
Mahbuba Siraj lives in Kabul, where she works as a women's rights advocate. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Millions of people have been displaced by war in Afghanistan and by the war in Syria. They're looking for places in Europe to rebuild, but Greece is now trying to keep migrants out. It's deploying military forces to its border with Turkey. For the first time in years, migrants in Turkey are pouring toward Greece because Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is allowing them to leave. Erdogan said his country could not handle them all.
Bize bir yük daha getirmek istediler.
I already warned Europe, Erdogan said. If they don't share this responsibility, Turkey would open its border gate. Migrants are also trying to get to Greece by sea. Today, a boat capsized with one reported death, a child. Devin Cohn is with Refugees International and was in Greece recently.
I do think that Turkey has a lot of power over this situation, and it is a dangerous sea crossing. Most of the refugees and asylum seekers that I've spoken to over the years, since I've both traveled there recently with Refugees International and also worked there before, most of them don't know how to swim. Most of them are terrified of the journey, and while it's a short crossing from Turkey to Greece in most places, it's not a safe one, and smugglers certainly don't prioritize asylum seekers' safety.
How do you think Greece is handling the situation? Because this is kind of the test. They're the first one to receive these asylum seekers now.
Greece already, you know, is completely overwhelmed. On the islands, particularly the islands of Lesbos, Chios, and Samos, where I visited, the capacity that Greece has to host and accommodate and feed and provide basic necessities for asylum seekers is over capacity by more than, well, almost 800%.
So Greece, obviously over capacity. Do you think they're doing enough, even in the situation that they find themselves in?
No, I definitely don't think they're doing enough. Certainly, they find themselves in a very difficult situation. We've seen it even this last weekend. There has been a lot of violence and clashes between local residents of the islands that are hosting the refugees and asylum seekers and Greek government riot units. The country is dealing with a real challenge, but a challenge that can be met and can be met in an organized, dignified fashion, but needs more help from the EU.
So the EU, you found in your report, provided over $2 billion for refugee support. So I'm wondering if these camps are still overcrowded. Why?
That's a really good question. Throughout my research, a lot of what I did was speak to the NGOs and staff that are working on the ground directly with refugees and asylum seekers. I mean, at the end of the day, they're wondering the same thing. Where is that money and why are the conditions so terrible? And even according to the UN Refugee Agency, you know, these conditions are as bad as any other major humanitarian crisis in the world where they don't have the resources.
How do you think the EU is viewing the situation as Greece struggles with these new arrivals?
I think the EU, for the most part, while they've given money to Greece, they haven't stepped up in terms of responsibility sharing. And I think how they're viewing this is they're both concerned, but also trying to keep the situation in Greece and not affect them as much as it does Greece.
Afghans make up nearly 50% of the asylum seekers in Greece. You were speaking with some Afghan women recently when you were on those Greek islands. What did you learn?
Many of the women I spoke to were elderly Afghan women who really don't remember or know anything about Afghanistan. What they do know is that it's not safe and that they fled for their lives. The situation in Afghanistan is not getting better, despite new political deals that are being made. I mean, it's still quite unsafe. Even if they were to return to Afghanistan, they don't know what they're returning to. What's really important to note is that for all asylum seekers of all nationalities in Greece, they are living, especially the ones on the islands, are living in really filthy, squalid, unsafe conditions, which is, given the fact that it's Europe and Europe has the resources, it's really quite unacceptable.
Devin Cohn with Refugees International, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Indian capital, Delhi, is on edge. Last week, 46 people were killed in 3 days of violence that largely targeted Muslims. Indian police officers are accused of standing by while people were attacked. it's difficult to get the police perspective on how all this is playing out or what it's like to be a police officer generally in India these days. The World's Rupa Shenoy spoke with one of the highest-ranking women among Indian police about her experiences.
As Inspector General of Police Railways in Bangalore, D. Rupa Madgal says she can't talk about politics or police brutality.
Though I have my own views, I can't criticize government. I'm bound by rules.
She can't criticize the government, but she can talk about her own experiences, especially as one of the few women in the service. They're estimated to make up 7% of India's 2.4 million member police force.
It is considered masculine, and you're not supposed to do that.
But Magdal did join the force, and her career has spanned nearly two decades, even though she's seen things she doesn't like how cases of assault against women are handled. The government says a woman reports a rape in India on average every 15 minutes.
I still haven't come across any woman who said that she boldly went up to police station and her complaint was taken without any effort. Such cases are very, very rare.
But changing things from the inside is incredibly difficult. Madgal found out just how difficult in 2017. She blew the whistle on a powerful politician who was serving time in prison for corruption. The lawmaker was receiving special privileges in jail, like access to cooking facilities and the use of five cells for her personal belongings. Madgal reported it.
And when I did that, a lot of eyebrows were raised from the people in the system, in the sense, my colleagues. With bated breath, they were waiting to see what will happen to me, what will happen next.
Because, she says, usually whistleblowers are punished.
The knee-jerk reaction of governments is to do away with the whistleblower. Just transfer that person or hush you up, and they try to dig your past and see what skeletons you have in your cupboard so that they can attack you.
That didn't happen to Madgal, she says, because she went to the media.
It was national media news for a few days. And I got tremendous support, humongous one, from the public. And probably that was the reason why I was not punished by the government.
So she says she wasn't punished, but she has been transferred 41 times.
Definitely transfers are, they cause a lot of discomfiture. You have to shift your whole family to another place and new school, new this one, everything, new setup. That is why not many people act, because the wise ones feel you better be silent and just close your eyes and just do your job.
So Madgal admits she's in an uncomfortable position.
But still, life goes on. It's fine.
Madgal hopes that by standing up to power, she'll show other officers that they can stand up too. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Travel can be inspirational. All artists know that. So for their new album, Berlin-based husband and wife duo Alexander Haka and Danielle De Picciotto packed up their bags and they hit the road.
Our new album is called The Current. And we recorded it in Blackpool, England. We didn't actually rent a professional studio for this because we like recording in unusual spaces. So we recorded over a fish and chips store, which was interesting because it always smelled like pancakes. I don't know if that influenced the music, but it was kind of nice.
We decided to do the recording in Blackpool, England, because it is a very different place from many other places that we frequent and dwell. It's on the northwest coast of England by the Irish Sea. It's like a run-down amusement city, if you will. It's a bit like Coney Island in its atmosphere, and it's very real. It's in a way that no gentrification and results of capitalism sort of seem to have it passed it by in a way.
So it's quite cinematic in general. We always call our music cinematic drone. Especially with this album, we also tried to integrate a couple of ideas, because we do have spoken word besides the lyrics, about the situation of the world nowadays and what we as artists can do to help.
50% of people got into the 21st century and the other 50% got stuck.
The whole world seems to be...
Blackpool is actually one of the places where there were a lot of Brexit voters, And that was also another reason why we wanted to go there, to kind of get an impression and understand more of why people were interested in voting for that.
The only way we're younger, we can free ourselves and remain sane is to take money out of the equation.
There's a lot of empty buildings, there's a lot of run-down buildings. So it's quite peaceful and quiet. There's not very many cars. And it kind of reminded us of Berlin in the 80s. And so all of this came into the album.
This song is called The Seventh Day, and it's about transformation. It's about growing and the responsibility we all have individually about what is happening to all of us together. So it is about transforming yourself in order to make good things happen for everyone around you.
That's husband and wife electronica duo Alexander Haka and Danielle DePicciotto. Their band is Haka DePicciotto, and their new album is called The Current. Before we bring the curtain down today, this was Tokyo a year ago.
Tokyo Marathon 2019, 通算 13度目の号砲が...
Pretty exciting start there at the Tokyo Marathon. Music blasting, huge crowds cheering, confetti fluttering down on the nearly 40,000 runners taking off at the starting pistol. That was 2019, as I said. This year, fans were told to stay home because of fears of the coronavirus, and only a few hundred elite runners were allowed to compete. The announcers tried yesterday to maintain the usual marathon excitement, but far fewer fans were there to cheer on the winners. Ethiopian runner Berhanu Legese crossed the finish line first. Lona Chemtai Saltpeter from Israel took the women's race. They ran large stretches through basically abandoned streets. For Japanese sports fans, this could be a preview of the main event this summer. Tokyo, of course, is scheduled to host the Olympics, but it could be canceled. Or Plan B, an Olympics like yesterday's marathon, without any fans. Hard to imagine. That's going to do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.